Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm Nan Evans, and I'm here today with Jeff Adams. Jeff is the Marine Water Quality Specialist with Washington Sea Grant, and Jeff is on the phone. And in the studio with me, Emily Grayson, who is a PhD student in the Department of Biology at the University of Washington. Emily tells me she's specializing in the biology of invasive species. Welcome to the both of you.
Thank you, Nan. Glad to be here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
First, as always, we'll start with a mystery sound, and then later on the program, we'll let you know what it is. This little critter actually makes a number of different sounds. So, as a little more information, here's another one of the sounds it makes. We'll come back later to the mystery sound. Now, let's see what's been going on around here lately.
This week's holiday, Labor Day, is reflected in the sky. The constellation Hercules, the strong man, shines faintly in the west after sunset. In mythology, Hercules had to labor not once, but 12 times. If you have a dark sky, look for Hercules, a large constellation stretching across the western skies. Check a stargazing chart first to know what you are looking for.
And Wendy Feltham reported that during the recent Natural History Society outing, led by Ken Wilson to the Dungeness, they saw or heard 44 species of birds, including the first migrating shorebirds. They also observed dozens of harbor seals, and yes, just a few late wildflowers along the way.
All ocean beaches in Jefferson County, including Discovery Bay, are closed to the harvest of all shellfish, and that includes clams, oysters, gooey ducks, moon snails, scallops, etc. And this is due to the risk of paralytic shellfish poisoning. If you insist on going clamming, Killisett Harbor and Mystery Bay are closed only for butter clams and varnish clams.
That said, always remember to check the Fish and Wildlife Department website for various up-to-date closure informations and do it on the same day that you plan to go clamming.
One of the most significant observations of the last week is rain. And that is good news, of course. The Associated Press reported that as conditions improve in some Washington rivers, state officials are easing fishing restrictions and closures put in place earlier this year because of the drought. The closures were needed to protect fish, which can be harmed by low river flows and warmer water temperatures. Fishing is now open or no longer restricted to certain hours on more than a dozen rivers, including rivers in North Puget Sound, South Central Washington, and on the Olympic Peninsula.
The return of the rain was also a theme in an email I received this morning from Jeff Hammerson. The email had photographs, which was wonderful, and there were several photographs of after the rains of rough-skinned newts migrating away from their breeding ponds into the woods, and of the male Pacific chorus frogs who started calling from their sort of winter resting spots in the forest. Another theme of this email and Jeff's photographs was family feeding. Down at the beach, Jeff had photographed a group of two adult and three river otters feeding away on gunnels. Gunnels are the sort of long, slim fish that look somewhat like eels. And there were photographs of an adult glaucous wing gull who had caught a juvenile rockfish and was feeding it to a fledgling gull. Presumably, that was the offspring of this year. Last July, Jeff Adams of Washington Sea Grant and Emily Grayson of the University of Washington came up to Port Townsend to lead a program for the Port Townsend Marine Science Center. Their subject was the invasive European green crabs. Well, today on Nature Now, Jeff and Emily have joined me to talk to our radio audience about these nasty little creatures. I have to sort of say, of course, they're probably not nasty in their native environment, but they seem to be nasty when they invade places like the Salish Sea. I did a little reading, of course, about European green crabs, and I learned that they first arrived from Europe at Cape Cod in the mid-1800s. By 1997, they made it to the outer coasts of Oregon and Washington. And in 2012, not too long ago, an established population was reported in Sook Harbor, British Columbia. Jeff, can you tell us a bit about the story of the European green crab, how it made its way from the coasts of Europe to the east coast of the United States and then on to the Salish Sea?
Sure. And thanks again for having us and allowing us to share some information about these crabs. The species are moved all around the world in all sorts of ways, and our best chance to reduce the impacts of green crab and others is really to address those pathways before they're ever introduced. And a lot of effort goes into preventing that sort of movement now, but in the past, we didn't give it that much thought or attention necessarily. So species like the green crab came from Europe to the east coast of the United States, likely in ship's ballast or the ballast water that were on the ships to keep them balanced as they loaded and unloaded materials and people. And, you know, sometimes people would intentionally or unintentionally move species as they would make these journeys. The first populations in California likely arrived in ballast water again, but much more recently from the East Coast. But it's actually a natural ocean current that brought them from California up into the western water of the western states. And in the late 90s, when there was a really strong El Nino, the currents were perfect for supporting these larval crabs as they're in the water column, and they brought them. And as that water moved north, it pushed them into different bays along the coast. And the populations in Oregon and Washington were not very successful ultimately in establishing abundant breeding populations, but several of the populations on Vancouver Island became very well established, extremely abundant, and continue to thrive. And as you mentioned, a thriving population was found in 2012 in Sook Inlet, just across the straits. Exactly, real close by. And that, again, because that's the first time they'd been found in the inland waters of the Salish Sea. So we may have been hoping that the straits were something of a barrier to them coming into our waters. But again, now that they're found inside, the concerns have been raised about them being able to spread more easily into our inland waters, which may be more suitable. And we have 2,200 miles of inland marine waters in Washington alone.
So, you know, that kind of raises the next question of, well, just what happens when the European green crabs do become established in a new location? What changes do we see in the local ecology?
This is a globally successful invasive species. It's established populations in Australia, Sri Lanka, South Africa, the southeastern coast of South America, in addition to the east and west coast of North America. So we've actually had a lot of opportunities to look at what happens to an ecological community when this new species arrives in lots of different contexts. And the primary way in which the European green crab impacts native communities is through its role as a predator. This is a crab that will eat pretty much anything it can get its claws around. It's a generalist predator, so that means it has a really wide diet. So it'll eat snails, bivalves like clams and oysters and mussels, and marine worms, as well as even species of crab that are smaller than it is. So primarily it can impact populations of native species by eating them. But I think some of the other effects that have been harder to anticipate are those that occur indirectly as the effects trickle through the complex ecological communities. So There's a really good story about what happened in Bodega Harbor, which is just north of San Francisco Bay, that I think is pretty illustrative of this complex.
So tell us the story in short form anyway.
Sure. So there was another non-native species of clam that had been present since the 1960s. And that species was kept in check by a native clam that was a better competitor. But in the 90s, when the green crab arrived, it turned out the green crab would rather eat the native clam than the non-native clam. And so by eating the better competitor, the native clam, the green crab created an opportunity for the non-native clam to become very abundant. Even though it didn't interact with the non-native clam, it indirectly facilitated.
Affected the food web.
Absolutely.
So it's the fact that they're generalists that make them so successful?
That's certainly one aspect of it. Wherever they go, they're happy to sample the local cuisine and find something to eat on the menu. They are also, like a lot of other successful non-native species around the world, in that they have a very wide environmental tolerance. They can survive at pretty low salinities and pretty high salinities, and that gives them access to habitats that other species can't. So they can actually take refuge from the larger Dungeness crabs and rock crabs that would be eating the smaller, relatively smaller green crabs in areas of low salinity because those large crabs won't go there.
And are the green crabs likely to be predators on juvenile Dungeness?
They can be, for sure. There's definitely been experimental work showing that if the Dungeness crabs, when they're young, are smaller and overlap in habitat, the green crabs are happy to eat those guys.
Okay, so now I'm going to ask you to paint me a picture. We're on radio, so you can't show me one. What does a European green crab look like? And how would I distinguish it from our just sort of native, like we've got a purple shore crab and we've got some hairy crabs. And what does it look like?
The first thing you think about when you hear the name green crab is the color, green. And that's a little bit misleading because they can be a wide range of colors. They can be brownish. When they're very young, they can be almost entirely white. So what we really look at when we look at telling crabs apart is the shape of their back shell. And that the crab lingo for that part of the crab is called a carapace. We have a bunch of native crabs that are very small. They're similar in size to the European green crab. But they have a very square back shell, just almost like a pure rectangle. And in contrast, the European green crab has a carapace that is almost shaped like a pentagon or a fan, one of those sort of a fan like a geisha would have and hold open. And the really best way to distinguish a green crab from the native crabs is to look at the number of spines they have on the edge of that back shell. So if you're looking at a crab from the top and you start at one of the eyes and count outward, you'll notice that each species of crab has a different number of those spines. Those are called marginal teeth. And the number of spines can help you tell which species. Our native shore crabs, the purple shore crab and the hairy shore crab, only have 3 of those spines, but the green crab has 5, and that's entirely distinct from any of the other native species that folks are likely to see on the beach.
So count the spines.
Count the spines.
I'm one of these people, when I find an interesting intact crab shell on the beach, I'll pick it up and take it home. So I was telling Emily earlier, when I was reading about this and getting ready for the show, I had to search through my collection of crab carapaces to make sure I did not have any European green crabs, and I did not.
Thankfully.
Yeah, thankfully, right. So now that we know to count the spines, and if you get to 5, we'll be concerned about it. Jeff, what are your biggest worries about the possibility of the European green crabs becoming well established on the Washington side of the Straits of Juan de Fuca and in the Salish Sea and down into Puget Sound?
Yeah, no, good question, because that's really the key to being an invasive species is there needs to be some reason that we're concerned about it. There's plenty of native species that have come from other places that we use in our daily lives, in agriculture and aquaculture, in landscaping that don't cause any harm. The success of the crabs on the Vancouver Island really kind of raised our concern about the habitats in Washington's inland waters, and that they'll make crabs feel right at home, allowing them to spread widely and have some of those ecological impacts and potentially some of the economic impacts to aquaculture that have been observed on the East Coast and elsewhere. It didn't really materialize as a problem when they invaded the outer coast, but there are concerns that if they're more successful in our inner waters, that could be a real problem. So having an economic impacts along with ecological impacts is really a double whammy.
So I'm thinking about aquaculture, and the thing that immediately comes to mind are the mussel farms. Are they successful predators on mussels?
They certainly are capable of doing so. I think some of the aquaculture techniques that we use for growing mussels could potentially protect their mussels from the green crab somewhat. So growing mussels off of the bottom mm-hmm. would make it harder for green crabs to get to them. But there might also have to be some adjustments to the way mussel farming is managed to protect green crabs if they are successful in locations where mussel farming is important.
Well, and then what about small juvenile oysters?
Definitely. So oyster beds are places where lots of other non-native species are found as well. So any small shellfish is vulnerable to crabs, and in places where they are farmed, oyster growers have already compensated somewhat for crabs as predators on their oyster beds. They set their oyster beds up in places where crabs are less likely to be problematic. So in some ways, the shellfish growers have indicated that they aren't as concerned about this species being problematic for them as folks on the East Coast mm-hmm. have been. And one of the reasons is that in Washington State, shellfish beds are largely managed privately for aquaculture. So you can do things like put nets over clam beds to protect the clams. On the East Coast, they're just starting to explore some of those ideas.
Of course, as you sort of implied earlier, there's always the, you don't know what's going to happen to the rest of the food web when you introduce somebody new and different who's an active feeder. I want to kind of go to the next step, which is, what can be done to prevent the establishment of green crab populations in our waters? And briefly, what would you suggest that the radio listeners do to help?
We are learning a whole lot about the different ways in which green crab and other invasive species are being transported. And as a result of that knowledge, there have been changes in the way shellfish industry activities are regulated and shipping industry activities. So ballast water is more heavily managed, and the transport of equipment and organisms for aquaculture is also managed to help reduce the probability of spreading this species and others. In addition, we're hoping that raising awareness through activities like this and through working with volunteers to monitor for this species can help increase our probability of finding them as soon as they get here. To our knowledge, they're not yet in Washington inland waters, and our greatest chance for eradicating them if they do arrive, or reducing their impact by reducing their numbers, is to find them as soon as they get here and before they get to such great population densities that they're just intractable, I guess.
So on my forays on the beach, if I find a crab shell that has five spines between the eye going out to the side, what do I do?
We have set up a Facebook page. Our group is called Washington WSG Green Crab.
That would be WSG for Washington Sea Grant Green Crab.
Exactly. And we would love it if folks would like our Facebook page, and they can also follow our Twitter feed at WA Green Crab, at WA Green Crab. And you can post pictures of what you think might be a green crab to our pages or to our Twitter feed. You can also report the species to the Washington Invasive Species Council through their reporting mechanisms. And then we can verify the identification and get some on-the-ground eyes to see if there really is an established population or if this was just sort of a transient episode.
In addition, thanks to funding from the Puget Sound Marine and Nearshore Grant Program and support from Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife and other partners, we are establishing a monitoring program to identify any populations that have moved around by natural currents and begin to establish in Washington's inland waters. And it's a volunteer monitoring program, so we welcome anyone interested to contact us through our Facebook page or Twitter feed or our email, crabteam@uw.edu, to express interest, and we'd be happy to get you involved in the program.
Okay, so let me ask you to repeat that email address again.
crabteam@uw.edu.
Well, thanks. I've learned a lot about a species I knew nothing about, and actually feel sort of assured that things are being done to hopefully prevent it from being established.
That's our
here.
Hope, too.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeff and Emily. This has been very interesting. Let's go on and let's hear that mystery sound again. That was the chestnut-backed chickadee. This handsome and tidy little bird resembles other chickadee species. But unlike the black-capped chickadee that I grew up with in the Midwest, this little bird's back and flanks are a rich reddish-brown instead of a slate-colored gray. Just last week, I enjoyed watching them bathing at a small garden fountain in my backyard. I'm sure that was before the rains, and I'm sure that recirculating fountain probably was the best water around. Chestnut-backed chickadees are common in the dense, wet coniferous forests along the Pacific coast. They also occur in some deciduous forests, particularly willow and alder stands along the streams, and in open patches of madrone and shrubs, and sometimes along the edges of oak woodlands. A curious thing about the chestnut-backed chickadee is that it uses lots of fur in making its nests. Fur or hair accounts to more than half of the material of the nest. Sometimes it's rabbit, coyote, or deer hair, but also hair from skunks, cats, horses, or cows appear in the nest as well. Another little cool thing is the adults make a layer of fur about a half an inch thick or so that they use to cover the eggs when they leave the nest. Sort of think of that as a chickadee blanket. Upcoming events. In the spirit of the beginning of the school year, at Cedar Root Folk School, classes for adults and youth in skills, tradition, and the arts of rural living in the natural environment are just beginning this month. And Wildwise, a school of outdoor adventure, is offering programs in nature awareness, wilderness survival, and folklore. Plus, for adult learners, the registration deadline is coming up soon to enroll in the new Washington State University Extension Services Watershed Stewards course. Contact Cheryl Lowe at the WSU Extension Service office here in Port Townsend.
Join the Jefferson Land Trust for a stewardship work party at the Lower Chimicum Creek North Preserve on Thursday, September 10th. You can explore and help care for some of the best protected habitat in East Jefferson County. Volunteers of all ages and abilities are welcome. Contact the Jefferson Land Trust for more details.
And on Thursday, September 17th, the North Olympic Salmon Coalition will be having a game and trivia night at the Poorhouse to celebrate the Salmon Coalition's 25 years of salmon habitat restoration, and to welcome the 2015 run of Hood Canal Summer Chum back to Chimicum Creek. Rumor has it that Finn, that 25-foot-long migrating salmon, will make an appearance.
Learn more about the Elwha River Restoration and Dam Removal Project and recent findings on the evening of September 18th in the upstairs Carnegie Reading Room of the Port Townsend Library.
And on Saturday, September 19th, join the Admiralty Audubon on a field trip to Fort Flagler, with stops along the Indian Island Isthmus Mudflats, looking for shorebirds and another stop at Mystery Bay before heading to Fort Flagler. Go to the Admiralty Audubon website for more details.
For a really wonderful outing, from September 22nd through September 24th, cruise with the Jefferson Land Trust for a three-day cruise aboard the Glacier Spirit with overnights at Roche Harbor Resort. Again, contact the Land Trust for details.
And one last announcement. Nature Now is looking for curious members of our community to help produce and host our radio programs. The job is fun and rewarding. You work with other great volunteers at this truly amazing radio station and learn fascinating things about the natural world around us. If you're interested, contact me, Nan Evans, at naturenow@kptz.org. Again, that's naturenow@kptz.org. So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news from the natural community where we live. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays, with repeats here on KPTZ, Thursdays at 5 p.m., and Saturdays at 11:30 a.m. Recent podcasts are also available on our website at kptz.org. Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is The Tinker and the Crab, performed by Donovan.
Nice as you please comes the traveling man, drinking a bottle of milk in his hand, speaking to no one in particular, but happily. Down where yon gulls dance, driftwood lying, drying for the fire. Yellow beak and sneak, now the gulls are crying, flying higher. Out from the sea came a little green crab, taking the sun, the morning being very drab. Oh, rusty cans, pebbles bedded in the sand, stand and stare. The tinker and the crab, the tinker and the crab, the tinker and the crab.